Hello and welcome to this podcast from the BBC World Service. Please let us know what you think and tell other people about us on social media. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
World of Secrets, Season 4. Al Fayed, Predator at Harrods.
Cash, with that you can control people.
Nothing comes for free.
Listen now wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Hello and a warm welcome to NewsHour from the BBC World Service, coming to you live from London with me, Sean Lay. The head of UNRWA, the United Nations Agency for Palestinian Refugees, is warning that food supplies in Gaza are running dangerously low. Philippe Lazzarini said some shelters have been forced to close for the first time since the war began a year ago. Mr. Lazzarini warned that at least 400,000 people were trapped in the north of Gaza. Many have left the giant Jabalia refugee camp to comply with evacuation orders issued by the Israeli Defence Forces, the IDF. UNRWA's Director of Communications is Juliette Tuma. What is the situation in the north of the Gaza Strip?
Yes, so right now in the north of the Gaza Strip, there's been more evacuation orders from the Israeli authorities, which means that people are expected to leave and be displaced once again. What we understand from several of the residents in the area is that many are hesitant to move because they know far too well from previous times that no place is safe in Gaza.
In terms of the practicalities of this, have the Israelis given any instructions as to what people should do when they leave areas where they're told they should leave because of the risk that they will face aerial bombardment?
Not really. I mean, what happens with these evacuation orders is that people are ordered to flee. And I'm not entirely sure that the term evacuation order does justice to what really happens. These are forced displacement orders where people have very, very little time to pack up whatever they can and to move in search of safety. But we know far too well from the events of the past year, this brutal war that is ongoing, that no place is safe in Gaza and no one is safe in Gaza and nothing has been spared, including civilian infrastructure like United Nations facilities and medical buildings.
Israel is very clear as to its explanation that Hamas uses civilians and civilian infrastructure to hide and act, if you like, as human shields to protect it from the Israelis, as they would see it, legitimate actions?
Well, first of all, to say that the use of human shields, if confirmed, is absolutely in contrast to international humanitarian law. That's to begin with. At the same time, these claims are very, very, very serious. And quite too often, this claim is used. So whenever we had an attack on a shelter that used to be a school of UNRWA, we often see the Israeli army coming out with this claim. And, you know, words are very powerful and they have very serious consequences. And this is precisely why, Sean, we have asked repeatedly for investigations, independent inquiries into such claims, because for us, it is very clear that the use of civilian infrastructure, including United Nations facilities, is a very thick red line. It's a violation of humanitarian law. But we need to find out what is actually happening. And for that, we need an independent inquiry.
The agency was created to look after the interests of Palestinian refugees wherever they may be. And obviously there are big camps in a number of countries, Jordan, obviously, but also Lebanon. The Lebanese government says about a quarter of the country is now subject to evacuation orders of one kind or another. What effect is that having on Palestinian refugees there? Have they been able to remain in the camps that exist or not?
Not really. No, they have been also impacted like the rest of the population in the south. They have also been on the move. some Palestine refugee camps have been totally emptied out. People have left them and they've moved into UNRWA shelters outside these locations. And for many of these Palestinian refugees, this is not the first conflict that they're going through. And the bottom line is that for many of them, this is previous trauma relived.
That's Juliette Touma from the UN's Agency for Palestinian Refugees, UNRWA. In Lebanon, the health ministry says four people were killed, 10 injured in an Israeli strike on a village near Sidon. Local media reports say the attack hit a hotel housing displaced families. The IDF says it struck more than 180 targets in Lebanon so far. Israel says it's targeting Hezbollah with the aim of ending the rocket bombardment which has driven thousands of Israelis from their homes in the north. Two Israelis were killed by Hezbollah rockets in the northeastern town of Kiryat Shmona. Rockets also struck the port city of Haifa, injuring at least five people. According to the United Nations, one quarter of Lebanon is now covered by Israeli military evacuation orders. That means 1.2 million people have been displaced. Tyre, Lebanon's fourth largest city, is 19 kilometres from the border, making it the Lebanese city closest to Israel. From there, the BBC's senior international correspondent Ola Gurin sent us this report.
Well, we've just had a strike very close to our hotel, right behind us. Incredibly loud, incredibly close. We can hear sirens now. First aid rushing to the scene, and there are some civilians I can see very close to the area of the blast.
The strike hit a high-rise building housing a pro-Iranian TV channel. One person was killed. Lebanon is being pounded like Gaza before it. Israel says it's targeting Hezbollah.
Well, this is just the latest strike that we've seen here over the past 45 minutes or so. We've had explosions and smoke filling the horizon. Israel has been intensifying its bombardment here. We're standing in an area of open ground. There is a very large trench which has been dug, a mass grave. We've been told that people will be buried here temporarily. They'll be exhumed later and taken back to their villages for a proper burial when the situation is safer. A plywood coffin is nailed shut. It holds the remains of a 70-year-old woman called Layla, killed by an Israeli strike. There's a handful of mourners, among them her grieving son. His pain is shared by many broken families here, and so is his rage. Until our last breath, we won't leave our land, he says. If we die, we will all be buried here.
I will stay on my office, on my home, on my land.
That's Murtada Mana, who runs a crisis unit trying to keep the city of Tyre alive. Getting food and blankets to shelters, getting fuel to hospitals. He's surrounded by a small team, some of whom had to flee their homes.
How much risk is there for you and your staff and your volunteers?
I think it's a critical and very dangerous situation for us because Israel, our enemy, and Israel didn't take care on Gaza. They bombed the babies, the children, the hospitals, the shelters. Already we're afraid from this, and if maybe they take this choice.
For all of Israel's airstrikes and its ground invasion, this is still a familiar sound in southern Lebanon. It's Hezbollah firing rockets across the border. the very thing Israel went to war here to stop.
Orla Gerin reporting from Lebanon. And later in the programme, we'll be hearing from Israel, from the former Prime Minister Naftali Bennett, who's been talking to the BBC's Jeremy Bowen about the options for Israel in its retaliation against Iran. Now, it's Nobel Prize season. The latest to be announced is the Chemistry Prize. It's being shared by three winners for their work on proteins. David Baker designed a new one. John Jumper and Sir Demis Hassabis developed an artificial intelligence tool to map their structure. The Nobel jury described this as a monumental achievement which could be used for designing medicines and vaccines, as well as many other fields. Now, I should ask Sir Demis's forgiveness because I've just mispronounced his first name. It's Sir Demis Hassabis, and he spoke to our science correspondent Palab Ghosh a short while ago and told him first about his surprise at winning the top prize.
It hasn't really sunk in, to be honest. I mean, it's obviously incredible, amazing honour, honour of a lifetime, and it's very surreal, really.
Can you just tell us, for people who are not scientific, what this breakthrough will mean? How will it affect people's lives?
We're going to see some new cures for diseases, terrible diseases, new drugs that can help alleviate that suffering that were at least largely or mostly designed by AI systems, obviously with incredible human experts in the loop, but combined, you know, and in a much quicker, faster rate than we currently do drug design, which can take, you know, more than a decade for a single drug to be developed. It'd be amazing if we can get that down to months instead of years.
And you're a computer guy. What made you want to solve one of the biggest problems in biology?
Well, I actually, you know, this is why I spent my whole life working on AI, is that I always saw it as potentially the ultimate tool to help accelerate scientific discovery. So I always had this in mind to tackle some of the biggest questions in science, like protein folding, with these AI techniques and AI systems that we're building to help us as scientists, you know, discover new things.
So you've solved a 50-year-old problem in biology. What's next? What other things can AI do for science?
Well, we're working on a lot of other interesting things, actually, ranging from materials design, designing new materials, to doing modelling of the weather and climate, to plasma containment in fusion reactors, to new branches of mathematics. So the point about AI systems is they're very general, so they can be applied to almost any field.
That was Demis Hassabis talking to Palab Ghosh, our science correspondent. Not forgetting, of course, his partner, John Jumper, who also helped him with the design of the AI app. And David Baker, who actually developed a whole new protein. Protein, sometimes regarded as scientists, as the very building bricks of life itself. So well-deserved award. Congratulations to them. Don't forget, you can always find a full list of the Nobel laureates as they are announced on the BBC's news website. This is NewsHour. Now, you are listening to NewsHour from the BBC World Service with me, Sean Lay. Coming up, have you ever wondered how an elephant's trunk gets its flexibility? A new study has found the answer in wrinkles.
It turns out they are very interesting, yeah? In elephants, everything has to do with the trunk. They're incredibly specialised animals, yeah? And the trunk is this absolutely extraordinary grasping organ.
President Biden has accused Donald Trump of being responsible for what he called an onslaught of lies over the US government's response to Hurricane Helene a fortnight ago and the forthcoming Hurricane Milton, which is due to make landfall in the next few hours. Israel's defense minister says his country's retaliation against Iran for its missile attack this month will be lethal, precise and surprising. And Ratan Tata, the influential chairman of one of India's biggest conglomerates, has died. Elephants, they say, never forget. But new research shows that nature has found ways to ensure that an elephant always remembers which way to bend its trunk. Because it seems just as humans may be left-handed or right-handed, Elephants are trunked left or trunked right. Professor Michael Brecht is co-author of a new study. He teaches at Humboldt University in Berlin. And on the line from there, he told me about the link between this so-called trunkedness and an elephant's wrinkles.
In elephants, everything has to do with the trunk. They're incredibly specialized animals. Yeah, elephants are extreme left trunkers, meaning they crest to the left of their body, or right trunkers, meaning they crest to the right of their body. In this particular study, we looked at the wrinkles on the trunk, and it turns out they are very interesting. Yeah, they are different between the two species of elephants that we looked at, Asians and Africans. And they seem to contribute to the trunk's flexibility.
So are there more wrinkles on, say, on the left or the right, or is it where the wrinkles are?
The left trunker would have a bit more wrinkles on the left side. But it turns out it's a small difference, yeah? But it's a very striking difference between left and right trunkers is the whiskers on their trunk. They look very, very different. Yeah, sort of a left trunker, he has almost no whiskers on the right side of the trunk, because in a left trunker, the right side of the trunk is sort of on the floor and gets upraised, yeah? And that's a very striking difference, very different. In a normal mammal, when we look at the face, the whiskers, they kind of look the same in a mouse, in a dog, in a cat, yeah? They look the same left and right. In an elephant, very different, yeah? There's one side in an adult elephant where they're all upraised, and the other side where they're much longer.
Why is there a difference between Asian elephants and African elephants?
It turns out the way Asian and African elephants crest is also a bit different, yeah? The African elephants, they have what they call two fingers on the trunk tip. This is two triangular structures, yeah? And with these two fingers, they pinch things, yeah? They're pinchers, yeah? Now, the Asians are different. They have only sort of at the trunk tip, only one finger. They can also clamp things and pinch something here and there. But what they like to do when you give them a big fruit like a mango or a melon, they wrap objects. Yeah, they sort of wrap the trunk around the object, and that's how they hold it. And we think that's also why their wrinkles are different. Yeah? Turns out the Asians have a lot more wrinkles than the Africans.
Because they're using the whole trunk.
Yeah, because the trunk needs to be more flexible.
Is there any other animal in nature that has something like the elephant's trunk, or is it really a unique and unusual organ?
It's a highly unusual organ. It's a highly unusual organ. So basically, when you're a very large animal, you need feeding specializations, because otherwise you cannot come up with enough food. Yeah, like for the baleen whales, this would be the baleen. For the sperm whale, it would be the diving. And for the elephant, it's this trunk. Yeah, it's a very specialized organ. We did a behavioral study. We had an elephant in the Berlin Zoo who had developed this habit of peeling bananas. Yeah, he has gotten that from his caretaker, yeah? And what she did, she would peel bananas, but she would do it three times faster than humans, yeah? And that's a trick, huh? Humans are really good at peeling bananas, yeah? They're very impressive elephants with their trunk.
That's Professor Michael Brecht, and I suppose the advice is when you're peeling a banana, just check which shoulder your elephant is over. You are listening to NewsHour from the BBC World Service. I'm Sean Lay. You're listening to NewsHour. There are plenty of cultures around the world where it's not seen as very masculine to talk about feelings, even less for men to discuss their own mental health. Centrum Scientific, an NGO in Kenya, says the way to a man's feelings may be through his hair, or more precisely, through the man who cuts and styles it. It reckons the barber's chair is the best place to get young men in particular to open up. Mara Anubi from the People Fixing the World programme on the BBC World Service has been to meet the Kenyan barbers trained to get their customers talking.
I'm on a busy street in a town called Bungoma, but I'm here specifically today to visit a barbershop. It's not just a place where people go to get haircuts, but men have a chance to talk about politics, football. And at this barbershop called 64 Classic Kinyozi, they're doing things in a bit of a special way. The barber, David Simiu, is shaving his customer's hair, and the conversation is all about stress. And the customer, Wanyonyi, feels he can open up when he's in the barber's chair.
I trust him. He told me many things like, be kind to myself. Maybe if my thoughts and feelings are dragging me, I just unhook them.
Davis is one of 30 barbers in the region who've been trained to support their customers' mental health. It's part of a project to help young men, which is run by a Kenyan NGO called Centum. One of their researchers, Arnold Satya, believes it's helping to break down barriers.
Mental health is basically a taboo topic in our society here. So by using an informal setting, we provide an opportunity for them to have a safe space to discuss and stimulate a conversation about these issues.
And they use a smart way to get the conversation started, specially commissioned music that talks about mental health.
I always ask my clients, are you okay with the music or you feel like I should change? He listens to the music and says, I'm okay. In fact, this music has a very good message. That's how we start communicating.
Gold Boy is a local musician. He wrote and sang this song called Tusemezane, or Let's Talk.
It felt so nice that my music can change somebody's life by reducing stress, because when people don't have stress, the economy is going to be okay, families, they're going to be together.
The barbers are trained to deal with mild to moderate mental health issues, but anyone they think needs more than just a chat is referred on to get more support. So far, the project has reached out to more than 1,000 young men. Arnold hopes that it can have a long-lasting effect on the way mental health is dealt with.
It's our hope that there's a shift in perspective. It will become a common conversation, and by doing that, we hope that we'll create a culture.
That was researcher Arnold Satter talking to the BBC's Mara Anubi in Kenya. And you can hear more about this story in this week's edition of People Fixing the World here on the BBC World Service, wherever you get your podcasts. This is NewsHour from the BBC. You're listening to NewsHour from the BBC with me, Sean Lay. Millions of people in the US state of Florida are on the move ahead of what authorities fear could be the worst storm to afflict the state since 1921. Although Hurricane Milton has weakened slightly Wednesday on its journey towards the United States, when it makes landfall, the latest predictions put that time at somewhere between 10 p.m. and 2 a.m., which gives you a sense of just how unpredictable a hurricane's path can be, even as the harbingers of that hurricane, driving rain, strong winds, are already being felt in the state. When it does arrive on land, it will be a much more powerful weather event than Hurricane Helene just a fortnight ago, yet it travelled over half a dozen states and killed at least 230 people. No wonder, as you received a briefing at the White House, President Biden was urging people to follow evacuation orders.
I know it's really tough leaving behind your home, your belongings, everything you own. But I urge everyone in Hurricane Milton's path to follow all safety instructions as we head to the next 24 hours. It's a matter of literally a matter of life and death.
Well, in fact, around 5 million people in Florida have been told to evacuate their homes ahead of Milton, which is expected to hit the state's west coast. Traffic jams are widely reported, with many gas stations running out of gas altogether. The BBC's Gordon Carrera sent this report from Tampa in Florida, one of the biggest cities in the path of the storm.
The streets here in Tampa are eerily quiet. Hardly anyone is around. Almost everyone seems to have followed the orders to get out ahead of what could be a massive storm surge as Milton makes landfall. Those who are left are often making last-minute preparations to save what they can.
The water was up to here. And that's from the last one, 2 weeks ago, yeah?
Just a flood.
I found Steve Crist working to board up his dental surgery.
I've lived here my whole life. I'm 73 years old, and we've never, ever had anything like this. Ever.
And to have two in 2 weeks.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, that building's never flooded. And I practiced dentistry here for 44 years.
Outside his building is a pile of debris, flooring and chairs, the result of flooding after the last storm, Helene, which hit just 2 weeks ago, killing hundreds and leaving many still missing.
There's so much damage all around.
Oh, my gosh. You just drive up and down. You just can't believe it.
Yeah.
Home after home after home after home after home.
There's not been time to clear things up yet, which could cause even more problems as Milton arrives.
And what I'm worried about is all this stuff tonight or tomorrow getting blown, you know, into the office. And I was hoping they would have taken this away by now, but they haven't.
That's right. They were trying to get rid of the debris today, weren't they?
And they're still working on it, and I'm sure they'll be working today and tomorrow, and maybe they will.
Yeah.
But in the meantime, there's a dumpster right down there I found, and I'm going to start hauling whatever I can to the dumpster.
Steve shows me on the wall where the water got up to with Helene, just a few feet high. But the fear is Milton could bring a storm surge up to 15 feet high. The results here in Tampa and further afield could be catastrophic.
So you're preparing the place now and then you're going to get out?
Oh, yeah, we're getting out of here. We're just trying to get things on the windows.
Okay.
So the windows don't break tonight.
Okay.
Just trying to keep the water out. That's all I'm trying to do.
I mean, it's pretty quiet here. I mean, everyone's gone.
Gone. I just went home and came back, and I've never seen it so quiet.
Yeah.
So people are either gone, or they're preparing their homes or whatever. But yeah, there's no one on the road.
Because it feels like this time people are taking it really seriously.
It was very serious. This is the worst we have ever seen. So it's going to be a lot of damage. So I can just hope for the best. That's all we can do, right?
The warnings that have come from everyone, from the mayor up to the president, seem to have got through here in Tampa. And there is a fear that even in a state used to hurricanes, that Milton could be different and dangerous.
Gordon Carrera. Well, before I came on air, I spoke to Sheriff Chad Cronist, who's in charge of the emergency response in Hillsborough County. A district hurricane watchers fear could end up in the eye of the storm.
I'm very grateful that so many people heeded the warning. Over the last few days, we saw traffic on our highways, just bustling. We even opened up the emergency lane to give those individuals who wanted to leave the opportunity to get out. I saw long lines at gas stations. Hotels here locally outside the evacuation zones are booked, and grocery store lines were just as extraordinary.
Can you describe what the scene is at the moment?
It's been raining for 2 hours. The wind has become so strong that the rain's almost coming in sideways. And again, we're at the tip of this storm. It's still 130 miles offshore, so it's not supposed to make landfall until later tonight, and we're already seeing the effects of this storm. My biggest fear is 12 foot of rain to an oversaturated area from the previous storm 2 weeks ago from a busy rainy season. I'm worried about the flash flooding from the 12 inches of rain that we're supposed to get. And then there's the most dangerous factor in this entire storm, and that's the storm surge. Regardless of what it is, 1 foot, 3 feet, 10 feet, it's going to be extremely large. It's almost like taking a snow plow and going in the ocean and plowing this water onto our shores.
The most terrifying thing, I guess, for people is the unpredictability of the storm. I mean, it's weakened ever so slightly, but it's still a major hurricane. You've had to deal with this less than a fortnight ago already with Hurricane Helene.
And that's the horrible part. We're still healing. We're still recovering. There's people who've lost everything. There's people who've lost a lot. We have debris stacked up that needs to be collected, and now you're adding a bunch of wind and water. Where's that debris going? It's going to be weaponized. I'm worried about the damage in addition to the water damage that's going to occur. Once these winds become sustained more than 40 miles an hour, we're not going to be able to respond. If you wanted to gamble and you wanted to stay, you gamble with your life and the life of your loved one. This last storm, Hurricane Helene, the winds never became sustained more than 20 miles an hour, so we were able to answer the 3,000 calls for service. This storm's going to be different. It's going to be catastrophic here in Tampa, Florida.
Can I ask you about those people who can't get out, who genuinely can't get out? I'm thinking of patients with severe medical conditions who are in a hospital and can't be moved. I think of people in hospices. What help and support have you been able to give those residents?
there's a lot of services. A lot of them have been relocated. Hospitals and voluntarily evacuated patients around to different facilities. We have shelters here that are open. We have special needs shelters, conditional shelters for those who need extra attention, that fragility that you're talking about, ones that are pet friendly. Overall, I'm happy. I have a lot of anxiety. I'm fearful. In 33 years of law enforcement, I've never seen the type of flooding that we saw 2 weeks ago, and it's going to be worse this time.
Well, that's Sheriff Chad Cronister in Hillsborough County. Michael Bobbitt lives in Cedar Key, an island city off the northeast coast of Florida. Michael, good evening to you. What's the situation there at the moment?
Sure. So we're just starting to get some heavy rainfall, and the water out in the Gulf of Mexico is starting to churn up. But I think we're still several hours away from when we're going to get heavy, strong hurricane force winds here.
You've decided to stay put. Some people might say not only is it risky for yourself, but you could end up putting others at risk if they end up having to come out to help you.
No one's coming out to help me. Once the wind gets 35 miles an hour, our rescue services here are not allowed to engage. And in fact, that's why I'm staying behind. We have some elderly residents here on the island that refuse to leave. And at some point, our emergency services can't get to them, but I can. I have military training, some tactical gear, and a rescue boat at the ready. And I'm staying behind to help people when I can.
That could be a considerable sacrifice, the risk to your own life as well as theirs.
Well, you know, everybody in their life has to decide what's worth taking a chance for, what matters to them. And to me, it'll always be this island, and it'll always be my neighbors here on Cedar Key. And to me, that's an acceptable risk. What would not be acceptable would be for me to turn tail and run and not be here on the island when I'm needed.
And what about the kind of practical preparations you've made yourself to try at least to protect yourself as far as you can?
Sure. So during Hurricane Helene, about 9 days ago, we were absolutely devastated by storm surge, up to 13 feet here on the island. I watched entire buildings being picked up and carried out into the Gulf of Mexico. Fortunately, we're on the other side of the storm this time, so we're not expecting this to be a surge event, but we are expecting to have the highest sustained winds ever recorded on our island. And the issue is that we have debris piled up multiple stories high all over the island. We're a target-rich environment for these projectile missiles. So we've got our doors and windows boarded up, and we're going to do our best to try to not have to be out in it in the height of the storm. But if someone needs help, I'm going to go get them.
Are you frustrated that this is turning into yet another subject in which the politicians seem to be knocking seven bells out of each other in Washington?
I absolutely am. And I understand that it's a political cycle and season in America, and everything is politics at a time like this. I couldn't care less what your politics are. If you're my neighbor and you're a Republican or a Democrat, I'm coming to help you. And the idea of using tragedy like this to support one side of the aisle or the other is reprehensible. And it's an example of everything that's wrong with divisive political party politics in America.
Michael Bobbitt, Navy veteran, doing your best for all your neighbours there in Cedar Key off the northeast coast of Florida. I can't think of a better thing to say than good luck, and you have our very best wishes. Thanks very much for talking to us here on NewsHour. Ratan Tata, the Indian industrialist and philanthropist who was chairman of Tata Sons for over 20 years, has died in Mumbai, India, aged 86. During his 2 decades in charge, he increased the profits of the firm 50-fold. Earlier, our India business correspondent Ashna Shukla joined me from Mumbai and asked her how seminal a figure he was for India.
Well, he was an icon. He was an industry icon. He was a philanthropist. He was a trade person who people looked up for, not only what he did in the industry, but also for his values. He was known as an avid investor and an astute industrialist. In fact, he ran the operations of the Tata Sons Group, which is one of the oldest business conglomerates in India, expanded the business beyond just a few businesses to, you know, now they do from salt to steel to software, taking on big giant brands from globally and bringing it under the Tata fold. And he's known to have you know, globalized the Tata Group in his tenure as chairman. So he definitely was an icon and an industrialist that everybody, from politicians to general people, to employees within the Tata Group, and even other people outside, valued and respected.
Has there been reaction from the Prime Minister, Narendra Modi?
Well, yes, he's tweeted his condolences on the passing on of Ratan Tata. He's called it a painful, and in his tweet, he's remembered the times that he met Ratan Tata, both when he was the chief minister in the western state of Gujarat, and even as prime minister. And his tweet was full of remembrances of his meetings with Tata. Ratan Tata, where he said his business acumen, he praised his the way he did business as well.
That's Archana Shukla in Mumbai on the death of Ratan Tata. Just worth noting that his remarkable stream of takeovers included the tea firm Tetley, the Anglo-Dutch steelmaker Corus, and of course the luxury auto brands Jaguar and Land Rover. You're listening to the BBC World Service. This is NewsHour. Now, we began this hour in the Middle East with UNRWA's warning about humanitarian aid in Gaza. We end with an Israeli perspective on its operation against Hamas there and against Hezbollah in Lebanon. The BBC's international editor, Jeremy Bowen, has been speaking to one of Israel's most influential politicians in Tel Aviv.
Naftali Bennett, former prime minister, and he is at the heart of what is a debate at the moment about how Israel retaliates for the ballistic missile attack last week from Iran. And you could say that a couple of forces are at work here, two forces. One is the influence of Joe Biden. He is very reluctant to see the US dragged into a war with Iran that he believes is not necessary, because the Americans do not think that Iran right now is trying to build a nuclear weapon. It has made progress if it wanted to, but they don't think that it's happening. So Biden thinks that would be a dangerous move. But on the other hand, there's a strong sense among some in Israel that they have an opportunity to deal a really serious hammer blow now to Iran, their mortal enemy. Now, why is that? It's because of Israel's military success, particularly against Hezbollah in Lebanon, but also against Hamas in Gaza. And while they haven't won in either place, they've caused a lot of damage to them. And those two organizations were seen by many around here as forward defense, if you like, for Iran. And now they're not able, perhaps, to fulfill that role. So the likes of Naftali Bennett think that this is a once-in-a-generation opportunity for Israel, that their enemy is weakened and they should move and not hesitate. So I went to see Naftali Bennett, and this is what he had to say.
So we're at the 11th hour, which was not the case 3 years ago. But there's also an ability that didn't exist until now, because essentially Iran was defending itself with two arms, Hezbollah and Hamas. They were sort of its insurance policy against a strike. But now both of those arms are pretty much neutralized.
So the defenses are down, is that what
exactly
you're saying?
Exactly, and the road is paved. So there's an urgent need that converges with an ability that did not exist, and we have a justification. I don't know what you call a situation where one country shoots 200 ballistic missiles on another. Then you've got Lebanon, who's been shooting tens of thousands of rockets on Israel. You have Hamas, you have the Houthis. There is a regional war taking place, but the head of the octopus that's conducting all this war is the only part that's immune. It's unbelievable if you think about it. All of this mess, all of this chaos, all of this death is being governed and managed from Tehran, yet they are the only ones who are immune.
From Iran's point of view, they might think they're defending themselves, because you think about it, Israel escalated the war in Lebanon. Israel decided to assassinate the leader of Hezbollah, Hassan Nasrallah, a very big ally of theirs. And so they were pushed into a position, weren't they, where they had to respond?
Quite the contrary. You're mistaking the events. What happened was, on October 7th, we were attacked by Hamas. And on October 8th, Israel was unilaterally, out of the blue, attacked by Hezbollah. So now it's a response. What we did in Lebanon to Hezbollah is a response to a whole year of them murdering dozens of Israelis, including 12 children.
Is it the case that really you want the Americans to do it for you, that Israel may start, but you need the Americans to finish? Because these sites are in mountains, buried deep. Israel doesn't have the capability, does it?
Israel has the capability to inflict considerable damage on Iran's nuclear program. We are not asking the Americans to do anything. I will point out, though, that just 2 years ago, President Biden signed a commitment, a pledge to Israel that America will prevent Iran from acquiring a nuclear weapon and will use all its tools available to do it. That's their commitment. I'm looking at what we can do. I can tell you we've never asked in our history of America to fight our wars or to send soldiers to fight our wars.
You couldn't fight without them. They've given you in the last year, according to Brown University, nearly $18 billion of extra military aid and an extra almost $5 billion into stepped-up U.S. military operations in the region. In fact, if you were without America, you'd be very lonely, wouldn't you?
We're losing boys, we're losing soldiers fighting the war on behalf of the West. We're doing the dirty work on behalf of the world, the thankless work. We're not asking for thanks, but we are asking, have our back.
Plenty of people would say it might turn it into a much more dangerous place if you don't destroy the facilities, and then Iran decides, right, we're going to go hell for leather for a bomb, and we'll make one.
Right now, it is as clear as ever, we need to act.
Why keep defying Joe Biden and the U.S. administration? Without them, you know, you might be in trouble. The fact is, they're the best friends you could ever want in Israel.
They are. America is an amazing friend.
So why are you saying that the president has got it so wrong?
We have the thankless job of taking out nuclear facilities of the worst regimes in the world. Everyone likes to criticize us, but we're doing that job.
Isn't this a great...
And if they get that bomb, it's everyone's problem. It's not our problem. I want to see how Londoners will feel when there's a intercontinental ballistic missile with a nuclear bomb. We cannot allow that to happen.
Now, you're out of politics at the moment, but the polls say that you are the favorite of many Israelis. If there was an election tomorrow, they'd vote for you. They want you to be prime minister. So are you doing this as a vote winner? I mean, this is popular, what you're saying.
I don't think it's popular. I think it's the right thing to do.
Popular in Israel?
I don't know if it's popular in Israel or not. I haven't done a poll. It's the right thing to do for the future of your children, my children, of the world.
Naftali Bennett, their past prime minister, maybe a future one too. Let's talk about the present occupant of the post, Jeremy. He's been on the phone with President Biden.
Yes, he has. We don't quite know. Well, we don't really know at all what he's said. There are a few things that come out of it. The Americans have said it was a very direct discussion. Obliquely, the defense minister has said that there would be some sort of, I can't remember his precise quote, a sharp response to Iran and a surprising one, without saying whether it would hit the nuclear facilities or not. You know, if the Americans are really adamant they shouldn't do it, I reckon, my guess is, the Netanyahu will not try to defy them. You never know, but that is my guess, because this is a long campaign. This is going to be a long war, and the Iranians need the Americans. They need their help. They can't do what they're doing without constant American assistance.
That's the BBC's international editor, Jeremy Bone, talking to me a little earlier from Israel with an update on that phone call between President Joe Biden and Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. It is said by various media sources in both countries that that was the first time the two men had spoken directly in nearly 2 months. This is NewsHour. Thanks for your company.
He owned iconic luxury brands.
Harrods was the ultimate glamorous shop.
The most famous people in the world coming there.
But Mohammed Al-Fayed used his wealth and power to control more than just his business interests.
Mohammed Al-Fayed was like an apex predator.
World of Secrets, Season 4. Al-Fayed, Predator at Harrods, from the BBC. Search for World of Secrets wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
What are people around the world doing to help tackle the climate emergency?
Climate shocks that we are experiencing.
Droughts, floods, decimated agriculture and so on.
The Climate Question from the BBC World Service looks for answers to those challenges posed by climate change.
How can we solve this?
It's all being discussed.
We only hear the bad stuff in the news, don't we? And there's loads of quiet progress.
Reasons to be hopeful.
Solutions exist. We just need to be able to implement them at scale.
The Climate Question. Listen now wherever you get your BBC podcasts.